Welcome to the Legally Sound Smart Business Show, your weekly look at legal news and questions in the business world. Here are your hosts, Nasser Pasha and Matt Staub.
All right, welcome to Legally Sound Smart Business. This is Nasser Pasha.
And this is Matt Staub.
And welcome to our weekly podcast where we go over some of the business news with our legal twist and also answer some of your questions to ask at legallysoundsmartbusiness.com. Let's get started to our first article. What do we have?
All right. So the first article this week deals with a lawsuit involving Getty Images, but not necessarily what you think would be happening. So this one involved a photographer who, I guess, put up a picture on Twitter. This was back in 2010. And Getty and AFP, which I believe is a French publication or something in France. I'm not sure, but
okay.
They took his picture off of Twitter, used it in all these different publications, media, all these different outlets without his permission, and just had a lawsuit. The damages were awarded. It was $1.2 million.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty crazy, which is, I believe they said it was the maximum statutory damages available under the law. But the reason I found this so interesting is because really the script was flipped on this one. Because typically we see Getty, and I know that we've both have talked to people that this has happened to, you see Getty sending out these, you know, essentially demand letters to people saying, hey, you're using our images on your website. You owe us this amount of money, pay up. And so this is kind of the exact opposite.
Yeah, so Getty Images, they're a repository of photos, right? And they usually sell them for use online and in print. And so when people have their blogs and so forth, even businesses, even when they hire web developers, what they'll do is they'll grab these images online somehow, and they may be owned by Getty Images, and then they'll try to enforce their rights. So you're right, this is a total flip of the switch. Is that what you said?
Yeah, it's a tongue twister, yeah.
Yeah, flip of the switch. So yeah, that's pretty interesting. And usually, what do we end up doing with those? Because in my experience, if you just ignore it, even if you do actually pay for it, they'll still send it to you sometimes because they don't have a record of it. And it's kind of hard for them to enforce. And I haven't really heard them going pretty aggressive on actually filing a lawsuit. Have you?
No, not that I can recall. I think there might have, I've talked to one person who knew somebody else who might have got involved a little bit deeper than just the letter. And I think there was some follow-up, but yeah, nothing, not too heavy of a pursuit.
Well, we had one situation, right? We'll keep it anonymous here, but someone was telling us that they had a photographer friend that actually sold images to some party to use on their website. Then later on, they sold the images to Getty. And now Getty is contacting that website owner because they're the same photos, obviously, trying to basically get money out of them.
Yeah, and I'm guessing, I don't know everything that happened there, but I'm guessing once they sold those photos to Getty, they probably waived all of their right to, because in this situation, someone had gotten the rights prior. I'm guessing that the person that sold it waived all those rights. And so the person who bought it originally is out of luck.
Yeah, because in reality, it's probably the photographer's fault, because I assume that when he sold his rights to the photos to Getty, it would have said in the contract agreement that Getty has exclusive rights and that no one else has any rights to these photos, which wasn't exactly true, obviously. And so now if this does get into litigation with that website owner, they'll have to sue or indemnify from that photographer and then bring him in the lawsuit. And then that's just a mess.
Yeah. One more thing about this article that I thought was really funny was, they were claiming that their actions, like I said, he posts the photos on Twitter. They essentially pulled them off and used them for themselves. They're claiming that they did not willfully infringe on the photographer's copyright. But this is exactly what they do to send out to what I would assume would be thousands of people and businesses a year. Like, I don't get how they can make that argument when this is exactly the thing they're doing. This, you know, this is probably another revenue stream for them. People probably get these letters, say, oh, I don't want to get involved in this. I'll just pay the fine or the fake fine, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So I thought that was pretty weak argument by them to claim that when they know what they did.
Yeah, that's true. I bet you a lot of businesses do end up just paying or responding or negotiating and so forth, which may or may not be the best way. It is risky. They could sue you and then the cost could be higher. And the reason why intentional infringement is an issue is because if they actually find intent that you actually had knowledge that this was someone else's work and you didn't have any rights to it, then the statutory damages are actually increased. So It's a big difference.
Yeah. It's good that Getty finally got something they deserved, but I'm sure the one point, well, actually, I don't know. I wonder how much they actually do collect each year from these letters they send out, if it's more than 1.2 million.
Yeah. And honestly, I don't know about deserving either, because we just talked about one case where it may not be fair for that website owner. But at the same time, a lot of these website owners and business owners do copy the images as well.
Yeah.
So I think they're just doing it to scare it away. I mean, I think a lot of photographers, they do sell their images to Getty, and there's really no value to those images if it's just being copied over and over again. But I agree with you. I don't like their kind of extortion kind of tactics of just sending mass form letters everywhere.
Yeah, and it's not worth the risk either. There's plenty of spots where you can get free photos, or even if you want to buy stock photos, it's pretty cheap.
Yeah, I thought they were more expensive. I think Getty is expensive because they have very unique and limited supply of how often they actually sell the rights. But yeah, there's plenty of stock images that are pretty inexpensive.
All right, let's get into the first question this week. This comes from San Diego. The question, someone's using our name. What do we do?
I'd probably just change your name.
Yeah.
Just go out to your next name.
Assume this is a business name.
Oh, yeah, that's true. If someone's using your business name, then I understand how it feels. It kind of sucks, but I would just change your name and move on with your life.
Yeah, especially if you've been in business for like 30 years. It's just time for something new.
Yeah. Well, rebranding's always fun. You can come up with a new logo. Well, anyway, so it depends upon what kind of rights you actually have in your own name. And if you're able to establish whether you have a registered trademark for your name and it's enforceable, or even if you don't have a registered trademark, especially if someone's using your name in your neighborhood, for example, you may have some common law rights as well. Now, it gets a little iffy if they actually have a registered trademark as well. And so that creates a presumption that they actually own it. But actually how to deal with this is also a different issue, because do you want to start fighting with your neighbor?
Yeah, that's a good point. But yeah, exactly what you're saying. It's protect and defend. You can get the IP for the name, and
yeah,
then it's about enforcing it. But I think this came up, and I can't remember if we talked about this on one of the earlier podcasts.
We've had so many episodes, so.
Yeah, no, it's hard to keep track. I know you and I have discussed this before, so I can't remember, but I think it was labeled the funniest response to a demand letter ever. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
It was some...
Yeah, I think... I don't know if I sent you that or... I definitely saw that. We posted it.
Yeah, it was pretty extreme statements they were making in the demand letter, but it kind of gets to this point. It's, you know, if you need to protect your name, and then you will have to... Well, someone can still take it, and then it's about, you know, going after them if you want to or if it's worth it.
But don't get crazy. You know, we have clients that get letters from supposed trademark infringement allegations in which maybe one or two words are similar, but then they're in a different business. Or even if they're in the similar industry, our name is a little bit similar or not. I mean, those kind of things. And it can get a little crazy. It's like, look, you know, what about free trade? And we're not even in your market, or it's not going to really affect you that much. And I think people can get a little too aggressive. And that was the demand letter that you were referring to, that whatever attorney sent that demand letter was stretching the law a little bit and wasn't making the demand in good faith, frankly.
Yeah, and that's why the response was pretty over the top. It was comical. Exactly what you're saying. And do your work up front. In California, at least, it's very easy to search a name. So
yeah,
do your work at the beginning, and then you don't have to worry about, well, I guess at the beginning, you don't have to worry about anything. And then if someone comes along, like in this situation, and steals your name later, then you can deal with it then.
Yeah. I mean, my last name is Pasha, and people keep stealing my name all the time. Even in San Diego, there's Pasha Mediterranean. There's Pasha Lounge.
Yeah.
I was thinking about filing something, but decided not to.
I think I walked by that once, and I think I said something to you, and you made some joke about that was your spot or your place or something. or they stole your name.
Well, I actually own the place, but I still was mad at that they were using the name. So,
all right, let's get on to the next article here. Oh, this is a good one. This was in Washington.
Washington State.
Washington State, yes. Someone sending out phony letters threatening businesses if they failed to buy posters. And these are workplace posters. I'm sure people are familiar with these. I have all the wage and labor law information on there. But I guess someone was sending out these threatening letters to businesses saying, hey, if you don't buy these posters for $300 a pop, I think, then you're going to get in trouble, I guess. I don't know how they pulled this off, or it seems like you would be able to tell if it was from the government, right?
Yeah, they add those logos and their name even may be similar to a State Department or something like that. It'll be like Department of Posters and Measures or something stupid like that. But yeah, this is a scam alert for all the small businesses out there. We should have a monthly scam alert. So this is our monthly scam alert. We'll probably never do that again.
Do we have listeners from Washington? I don't know.
Probably.
Hopefully.
We're nationwide.
Yeah, that's true. This actually reminds me of getting it to California here. This reminds me of the Franchise Tax Board.
Yeah, you're right.
What they were doing is, it was coming from the Franchise Tax Board, and they still do this. They're just sending out letters to individuals and business owners saying, I think it's more individuals that it gets wrong, but they're saying, hey, you owe us this amount of money based on, you know, previous year's income, or I know some of them were based on their mortgage payments.
Okay.
And they were doing that, but they're sending out, I've helped multiple people out with this. They send something, hey, you owe us $15,000. And I talked to the person, they said, yeah, I didn't even work that year, so I don't know what they're basing it on. Yeah. But it's just, like I said, previous year's income. And I've talked to people at the Franchise Tax Board, and they've told me this. That's what they're basing it on, these things that, it's just dumb.
It's dishonest.
Because they know income that's reported, so if you don't see the income, then I don't know how, I don't know, I'm getting off track. But
no, you're right. It's upsetting, and obviously people get scared. Now they have to spend the time not only figuring it out, but possibly even hiring an attorney to fight it, right? And that's just unnecessary.
Yeah, that's true.
But this Washington company, they're taking advantage of something that businesses have to do anyway, right? It's different by each state, but with your employees, you actually have to have these posters in the break room or some other area, depending upon, again, the state. But usually both federal and state law, and you've all seen them. Believe it or not, the California's poster is pretty good. It actually has some good material on it, both for employers and employees. I'm impressed with that. But at the same time, who actually reads that stuff besides lawyers?
Yeah, I know. I like California's poster so much that I have it hanging up in my condo. Pretty nice.
Oh, yeah. I know. I've seen it.
All right. Let's get into the next question here. And this comes from someone in Rancho Santa Fe. Oh, maybe it's Phil Mickelson. Who knows?
Oh, Phil Mickelson wrote in.
It's a tax question, so it probably is Phil Mickelson after he had said he was going to move from California last year because the taxes were so bad.
That's true, and he has a home office, so we'll get to the question. Sorry, I'm jumping ahead.
Question is, I work from home. How much of my rent can I write off for this year? Rancho Santa Fe.
Wonder what kind of business he's running as a golfer. He is a golfer, right?
Yeah, he's a golfer.
Nice.
And he does make a lot of money. So I don't know if people are familiar with this, but if you have a home office, you have to qualify. I mean, there's some rules for it. It has to be exclusively used on a regular basis for business purposes. But in previous years, it would be just a percent of whatever your entire house or dwelling is. So let's say your room is, that your home office is 200 square feet and your place is 1,000 square feet. So you could take 20% of whatever you pay, rent or mortgage payment, and that was your home office deduction. This year, for 2013 filing purposes, the IRS has rolled out this new simplified option that allows someone to just take, it's very simple, $5 per square foot of their home used for business, maximum 300 square feet. So a maximum $1,500. I've done the home office deduction on the forms. The math made sense to me, but actually using the form in years past is just really complicated. It's overly complicated. So I'm glad they have this simplified option, but it's $5 per square foot, and that's all it is. Pretty simple.
It makes me wish I had a home office. I need to just have one now.
You can just turn one of your rooms into one.
One of my many rooms in my mansion.
Yeah.
I think I might have an office somewhere in my mansion. I have to look.
I'll find that one day. Let's take a break here. And I don't know if you saw this week. This is, well, I shouldn't say funny, but the way it was recreated was just really interesting. I don't remember ever seeing something like this before. We were talking about the Bob Filner lawsuits.
Yeah.
And I guess the attorney involved in this case made some animation of Filner I guess it was some event at a park. It's about almost 2 minutes long, the video.
Well, let's give some background here, right? So Bob Filliner, he's the now ex-mayor of San Diego for you outside of San Diego folks. I swear he goes great with that mayor of Toronto, right? I mean, it's just another mayor scandal. What's his name? Ford?
Yeah, Rob Ford, maybe?
Yeah, Rob Ford. So Bob Filliner faced a number of accusations of sexual harassment and ended up actually pleading guilty to battery and false imprisonment back in October. But now the lawsuits are actually starting to materialize. And this litigation attorney made this animation, which we'll put a link to, but it makes Filliner look so creepy. I don't know if you've actually seen it, but his eyes are bulging like bug-eyed and very awkward. I'm sure it was awkward, the actual circumstance, but it looks a little goofy, I swear.
Right, and I think they said they even dialed it back. The video is dialed back from what actually happened. But yeah, he does not come out looking great from this video.
Yeah.
Or from this cartoon or whatever it is. Yeah, we'll link it and let people see it if they haven't already. I just thought it was pretty weird. I've never seen anything like this before.
Yeah, they always have videos like in criminal investigations to kind of reenact the scene in the trial. But I haven't even seen this in a sexual harassment case. I guess it would be a battery case, actually.
Yeah.
There's a lot of legal talk, too, right? As whether or not this will be admissible. And the defense attorney, or I should say the plaintiff's attorney, seems pretty convinced that the judge will let it in.
And I think they said also in here that, you know, maybe this will prevent people from doing similar things in the future, because then maybe it'll be reenacted in a cartoon.
Yeah.
I'm guessing the reason they're doing this is because he's a public figure, or was a public figure. So
yeah,
that's the whole reason.
I think there's other ways to deter those kind of actions than an animation. But you know what? I wonder, again, we've talked about this before with similar cases, of whether or not he's doing well for his client in bringing all this publicity. Because it's not like he can use this as evidence, but they may be able to let it in as far as in the summation or something like that. But who cares what the public opinion is? They're not the ones deciding whether he's guilty or not.
Right. Well, that was a nice little break. We'll get into the next article here. I think there's a theme for this week. It has to do with people being taken advantage of, especially smaller people. We've heard about this before, but I guess it's popping up more in this region here in Southern California, some of the smaller areas. But disability suits targeting small businesses. I guess, yeah, it's more inland businesses in this article. Essentially, what's happening are small businesses, I think they're described more as, you know, small mom and pop shops, are being targeted, in my opinion, targeted, but it's for, you know, not adhering to the American with Disabilities Act, things like that. I know the most common thing getting mentioned in this article is handicapped parking spaces not being big enough or just not even being there at all. And I don't want to downplay the, obviously you need to have things for disabled people to get into your store, restaurant, whatever, but this is just attorneys taking it too far, I think, in some instances here.
Yeah, unfortunately, this is a reoccurring theme. This article is not alone. You can probably do a quick search. This was in December 6th, right? And so you can take a look at the history, and almost every city, region, or small town has been hit by an attorney that they just go from store to store or from commercial space to another. And the reason is because in order for the attorney to make money, because the law has changed a little bit, there are statutory limitations and so forth to damages, that it's a volume business. You can compare it to any other personal injury attorney or bankruptcy attorney that goes through this. Now, the law has changed in the sense that no longer can they send out these demand letters, that when they do send out any kind of letter, request to fix, or intent to sue, they have to spell out what's wrong with it. But of course, this is the world we live in as far as attorneys go. It's a very difficult market for attorneys because of how many attorneys are out there. And so this is how they make up for it. And unfortunately, good attorneys gets the bad rap for this.
Yeah. And I've actually heard of, I mean, in San Diego, I know, I don't know who the actual attorney was, so I don't even need to protect the name, but I heard through another attorney, they said, yeah, I know this guy. He basically, what he does is he has a couple seniors that he works with, and yep, they just find a place that looks like the code's not up to date, and they go in and say, hey, and I think in one of the examples, it was it was something to do with the actual inside of the structure. It was too narrow, or it was the stairs or something that would be very difficult to fix. And you're like, hey, well, you need to change this or you're going to get sued. It's like, this is a terrible way to live. You're an attorney and this is how you're going to spend your time going out there and righting these supposed wrongs. I think the attorney mentioned here he filed 12 lawsuits in one day at one point.
Yeah,
it's just crazy.
Well, it's also unfortunate for the disabled, right? Because the intent of the law is great. But I think because of all these attorneys that do these kinds of things, it gets a bad rap. And then all of a sudden people get kind of anti the law as well. And they kind of miss the bigger picture. There was even in Julian, which is a very small town in the mountains east of San Diego. It's about an hour or less, actually, to get there. And an attorney did the same thing. And these small restaurants and buildings were there a long time ago before these laws were even contemplated. And just think about these kinds of acts that they're not targeting businesses that have a ton of money that can afford to fix. We're talking about very small businesses sometimes that been around for a while and it's a family-owned business, and rebuilding their structure, which is sometimes what it takes, is too much for them.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I think it's a disservice to disabled people. It's really making people read this article or hear these stories and they're maybe putting their anger with the wrong people. It should all go towards the attorneys and not, like I said, disabled people definitely need to have ability to get into stores, restaurants, etc. But this isn't the way that it needs to be done. It's pretty unfortunate.
Lastly, is you take a look at the article, which we'll post. This, I think it's an oil change business. They're being sued because they don't have any disabled parking spaces. The funny thing is they don't have any parking spaces at all.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's a drive-through oil change place. And so it's such a small place that they don't have room for one. So what are they supposed to do?
Yeah. Some of these are really bad targets. Other ones, I'm sure some of them are completely legitimate and will help society, but yeah, like that example, just terrible.
Yeah, I agree. And for example, when you sign a lease or even construct something new, almost always ADA is contemplated and discussed, and that compliance is pretty strict because of these laws, but it becomes more difficult for those older businesses.
Let's get into the last question here. I'm starting a company with 50-50 ownership with my business partner. We want to include something in the contract that puts a minimum on the amount of time a partner can commit to the business. How can we do that? And this is from a business owner in Long Beach.
Okay. What do you think, Matt?
I'm just going to say no, and they can't, and move on and change your name.
That's my answer, too. Well, I don't like the fact that they're 50-50.
Yeah.
I know there's partnerships and so forth, but just in our experience, it's always not a good combination. Because even if we have an answer for you, which I'll give you in a second, implementing and enforcing that answer is also difficult when you have a 50-50 ownership. But to answer your question, just to repeat it, we want to include something in the contract that puts a minimum on the amount of time a partner can commit to the business. I think what they mean is a minimum that they have to, right? I think that's just worded differently.
I would assume, and you're exactly right, it's something you can put in your agreement with that business owner saying, hey, you need to allocate X amount of time towards a business. I think this is biggest in startups, especially if people are involved in multiple companies or they have a day job, but they're also doing this startup with somebody else. This is when it really comes into play.
And you can get creative too. There's something called vested interest and cliffs and so forth. And instead of using the terminology, it's very simple, is that from the get-go, every month or every quarter, however period you want, if you satisfy the aspect of devoting X amount of time to the business, then you'll be granted X number of shares per period. And so the concept is if you don't, then your vesting will stop and therefore the other partner will start to accrue more percentage because they'll be being issued more shares or more units, whether you're LLC or corporation. But again, the problem is how do you enforce that? Because if there is any kind of dispute, because it's a 50-50 ownership, then either both of you have to agree or you go to court to determine whether or not you're actually complying with those terms of the agreement. So that's why, again, I don't like that 50-50. And there's other ways to do it too. You know, again, you can get pretty creative with option agreements. So for example, you can have it so that if one of the partners leaves after within X period of time, let's say 2 years, then the company has an option to purchase the shares or units at a specified price, usually lower than what it's worth, So that way that shareholder or member has an incentive to stay with the company for that full period. And, you know, you can get pretty creative with that, but you need an attorney to draft that. And that would be in the shareholders agreement or members agreement.
Yeah, that's much better than my advice of change your name.
Yeah.
Equal ownership is tough. It's definitely going to happen. You're going to have some sort of disagreement. And then what do you turn to if you guys both have equal say?
Or you can still have 50-50 if, as far as my advice goes, you can have 50-50 if you give one partner a controlling interest. So they can still have 50% of the company. But then as far as how you structure the corporate structure, you make it so that one has actual control of the company itself.
Yeah, that's good too. All right, we'll get into the last article for today. And
yeah, I know why you chose this one.
Giving the listeners what they want. We're back and it's a pizza-related article.
Nice.
Doesn't really have to do with pizza that much, just Domino's.
I think they sell pizza, right?
I think so. I don't know. Give me 5 minutes to read through this real
quick. Let's do some research. Wikipedia, Domino's.
They do. Okay, I see someone holding a pizza.
Okay, good.
This is in New York. The 25 employees of Domino's have been reinstated after an issue they had, where I guess they were getting paid, some of them getting paid as little as $1.60 an hour, but it's because they get tips. So with the tips, it'd be above the minimum wage in New York. The problem was they were doing all this untipped work, such as cleaning or kitchen work. Obviously, you're not going to, unless you're really good at doing dishes, you're not going to get a tip in the back room there. So
here's a tip, use soap.
Oh, there you go.
I give tips to waitresses all the time, just like that.
I will say, well, I did work for a chain pizza place briefly, and
by the way, you always say a chain pizza place, but you never say which chain.
It's Donato's. I don't know if you've been in the Midwest.
I'm from the Midwest, but I haven't heard it. Wait, Donato's? I feel like I know it, but I'm not sure. Anyway, go ahead.
The way it was structured there, which was pretty cool, was because I worked in the back, I made pizzas, did all that stuff. The servers would have to share their tips with us, which I always thought was a little bit suspect, because what's going to prevent them from just pocketing the money and saying, oh, we didn't get that much in tips, but at least it was shared a little bit with us, which I thought was pretty nice.
Also, that concept's odd in the first place, because you would think the purpose of a tip is to reward good service. And so therefore, if the waitress is really good or really bad, that's independent as to how good the dishwasher is, right?
Yeah. I don't know what the minimum wage is in New York, but I know this sort of situation can't really happen in California because the minimum wage has to be without tip, which is $8 an hour right now.
Yeah, they don't discount for tips. It's a strange rule, right? Because you have all these minimum wage laws and then all of a sudden, you know, someone gets a job and they're saying, well, I get paid $1.60 an hour and they're dependent upon tips. And in California, I think a lot of restaurant goers or other tip related industries, people aren't used to that. But in states like New York and a lot of other states, US actually, these guys depend upon the tips so much that if you don't pay tips, then they're not going to get to eat that night.
Yeah. And my guess is they'd have to, I'm sure it's structured where they always hit, or they pretty much always hit minimum wage. But I would think if there was ever a gap in between the minimum wage and the amount they, if let's say they don't get that many tips, there's not that many customers, I would think the employer probably has to compensate them up to the minimum wage amount, is my guess.
You're absolutely right. It's a credit up to a certain point that they can do. What's funny with this Domino's franchisee actually fired these 25 employees because they complained about this, which is probably the worst thing employer can do, because that's basically a wrongful termination. If you fire an employee because they're complaining about some kind of statutory violation or whatever, or labor law violation, and you fire them, then forget about the minimum wage you may owe them. You're going to be responsible for their wages in the future as well, until they find a job for wrongful termination. So that's why they rehired them, of course.
My biggest issue with this is that Domino's even exists in New York. I don't get why there needs to be a Domino's when you can't even walk a block without hitting some sort of pizza place that they're selling pizza on the street.
I agree. Again, a great reference to The Office when Michael Scott visits New York and then he goes to Sbarro or whatever, instead of he's like, best pizza in New York. I love that.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
Didn't Donald Trump and Sarah Palin go there too when they visited? That was a whole news article about that.
It could have. Yeah, it's I'm not sure. We'll look into that for next week.
Okay, we'll hit our research team and get on that. We have a pretty fun guest coming up next time.
We do. We're excited.
Looking forward to that. We'll keep it a secret for now, though. But the clue is someone really cool and in San Diego.
Yeah.
That should narrow it down.
You know.
All right, well, very good. I think that's it. Thank you for joining us for our 9th episode, and we're almost to double digits.
Yeah, pretty exciting. We're going to do a best of the first 10 episodes.
And a blooper reel at the end, too, as well. Actually, yeah, the next episode will be nothing new, just old episode clips. I hate those kind of episodes.
Give the people what they want, yeah.
All right, well, thank you for joining us. This is Legally Sound Smart Business.
All right, bye, everybody.
This has been the Legally Sound Smart Business Show with your hosts, Nasser Pasha and Matt Staub. The Legally Sound Smart Business Show is your weekly look at legal news and questions in the business world. Legally Sound Smart Business is a podcast that is intended but not promised or guaranteed to be current, complete, or up to date, and should in no way be taken as an indication of future results. No attorney-client relationship is created by listening or submitting questions to the podcast. The podcast does not constitute legal advice, but rather is offered only for general informational and educational purposes. You should not act or rely on any information in the podcast without first seeking the advice of an attorney. The opinions expressed in the podcast reflect the views of those individuals and do not necessarily represent the views of any other individual or business. For more information about the Legally Sound Smart Business Show, visit legallysoundsmartbusiness.com.
How was that intro, Matt? Did that work out well?
Yeah.
All right, very good. I'm trying to work on that, but it's becoming too robotic, I think, so to make it more natural. I swear, he goes great with that mayor of Toronto, right? I mean, it's just another mayor scandal. What's his name? Ford?
Yeah, Ford.
But anyway.
Rob Ford?
Yeah, Rob Ford. So that's probably not even it. We just made that up.